This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Think about what determines your class, how much money you have, who your family is, what kind of job you have. Well, those same factors influence the class of an enslaved person in the antebellum South. Scholar William Andrews combed through more than 60 slave narratives to better understand the role of class in slave communities before the Civil War. He discovered that social and economic differences played a key role in the process of liberation. William Andrews is a professor in the Department of English and Comparative Literature at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's the author of the book Slavery and Class in the American South, A Generation of Slave Narrative Testimony, 1840 to 1865. Bill, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You went through at least 60 slave narratives to prepare this book. When were they? Well, 1840 to 1865, I'm guessing.
Yeah, that's why it's called a generation of slave narrative testimony. It's not just a few people who are very well known. My book deals with those people. But in order to understand class, you have to understand the full range of experience that that people wrote about in their narratives. So I went back to the international heyday of the American slave narrative, 1840 to 1865, a quarter century, when the African-American slave narrative from the United States was the biggest literary import, or I should say export, that our country created. I mean, it was, as one critic put it, the mournful honor of the United States to contribute to world literature the literature of the slave. But nevertheless, these narratives came out in profusion, and they reached international audiences. They were translated into multiple European languages, and they went around the world. In order to understand class, we have to look at everybody's experience, not just the experience of the ones, the people we're most familiar with.
We'll talk about those, because you would almost think that there's a class all by itself, and that would be those who chose to make their narrative public. I mean, that seems to me to be a class of individuals. But even within that subgroup, there are great distinctions in how they lived and what they were doing.
The people who got out via escape tended to be people, and their narratives show this over and over again, tended to be people who escaped from slavery from the highest echelons of slavery. Why? Because it was easier. It wasn't easy to escape from slavery under any circumstances, which is one reason why many people bought their way out of slavery rather than attempting escape. But the record shows, because you can read the narratives and see what kind of situation many of the famous people were in before they managed to escape slavery, and their situations were what I would call from the upper echelon rather than the lowest echelon. That is, these were people, a Frederick Douglass, a Harriet Jacobs, a William Wells Brown, a Solomon Northup. These were people with multiple marketable skills, and they knew it, and they knew how to market those skills, and in many cases they were able to earn money while they were enslaved using their skills. So having those kinds of skills and then the other factors that influence class, such as where you live, who you know, and what your family is like. Do you have a family? Do you have an extended family? Are they respected? Do they have a reputation that gives you a certain kind of clout? All those factors have to do with how you are able to marshal the resources, material, psychological, spiritual, that enable you to make a successful break and get out of slavery.
Let's look at a few examples and ways in which those special skills did allow you to get out and then also create a narrative that would be publicly distributed.
Well, let's take the most famous slave narrators. On the male side, Frederick Douglass. On the female side, Harriet Jacobs. Frederick Douglass, in his narrative of 1845, says that The last months that he spent as a slave, he worked as a caulker, a ship's caulker, in the port of Baltimore. He says that he was able to command the same wages that a white caulker could command. He used those wages to the extent that he was allowed to keep them, and of course his master took most of what he made and said, "That's my due for allowing you to work as a self-hired slave." But what Douglas was able to keep for himself, he used to help pay his passage to get to the North. If Douglas had not been living in Baltimore, so he's greatly advantaged over the fact that he's an urban slave. If he doesn't have those skills, if he doesn't have the supremely important skill of literacy, it's going to be much harder for him to escape, especially compared to where he started out. He started out living on the eastern shore of Maryland, way out in the boondocks, on a plantation. The chances of escaping from such a place are much reduced. So Douglas really moves up the social class ladder within slavery.
How does he get those skills? And was the ability to gain those skills available equally? You suggest that it's really not.
Oh, no. The reason why he learned to read is because he was sent from the plantation where he was born into Baltimore. And so he moved from a rural area to an urban area, and he says in his autobiography, in the narrative, that a city slave is almost a freeman compared to a country slave, or in his case, instead of having to work as an agricultural worker, a so-called field hand, he became a domestic slave. And his early life in Baltimore, from the time of 8 until the time he was in his mid-teens, he was basically a domestic slave who had certain advantages, one of which was time to roam the streets of Baltimore and pick up knowledge and learn things. And one of the things he learned from finding a scrap piece of newspaper was that there was such a thing as abolitionists. This is the kind of thing that puts you in a different class. Once you know things, once you live in an environment in which there's a lot of information moving around, you know things that people who are working on a plantation just never have an access to get.
Now tell us about Harriet Jacobs and the importance of family and connection.
Yeah, Jacobs is also another urban slave, and she comes from an extended family. Although both of her parents died when she was young, she had a maternal grandmother whose name was Molly Hornyblow, who was a tremendously powerful influence on Harriet's life. She was her model for what a proud, dignified African-American woman should be, regardless of whether she's enslaved or free. So when Jacobs decided that she was bound to get to freedom, she had the kind of psychological equipment that enabled her to continue to resist the sexual predator master whom she had, continue to insist on her goal is to get out of slavery and to get her children out of slavery, and to use the connections that she had in her family. And her family had social connections with upper crust white people in the town of Edenton, North Carolina. All that creates a network that enables her to be protected while she's hiding out until she can finally make her escape.
You know, it's interesting to think about that, the way family connections and social connections work, particularly in an institution, one of whose great horrors was to separate families. And while
yes,
that was true, you talk about the fact that to the extent that families were connected, this was a source of strength.
Oh, over half of the slave narrators who published their stories between 1840 and 1865 had experienced some degree of family separation due to sale. But that doesn't mean that their families were completely dissolved. It means that they lost someone important, but they also retained other people who were extremely important to them in terms of building up their sense of self-respect, their sense of you deserve better than what the masters decided that you're worth. And the skills and the ways that people could use those skills to attract attention and gain reputation and find social respect, those kinds of skills also built up people's self-confidence, gave them experience that helped them to think, I don't have to be a slave. I can take care of myself if I just had the opportunity.
Frederick Douglass writes about his grandmother in his second narrative, right?
Yes, in the famous narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, an American slave, he hardly mentions his grandmother except to speculate on how she died. But in his second autobiography, My Bondage and My Freedom, which came out 10 years after the narrative, he talks extensively about Betsy Bailey, Frederick Douglass's very name that his mother gave him, Frederick Augustus Washington Bailey. That name, Frederick Augustus Washington, tells you something about the class identity that she wanted her son to have from his very birth. And his grandmother was a woman of enormous accomplishment and skills, and yet still enslaved. That made a huge impression on Frederick Douglass as a little boy. And the fact that he got to be with his grandmother, that his grandmother raised him until he was 6 years old, meant that she left a permanent imprint on him that he remembered and treasured and that he describes in detail in My Bondage and My Freedom.
We've been talking about the upper echelons of society within enslaved societies. What about those who were didn't come from that class?
So the majority of enslaved men and women in the American South worked in agriculture. They were outdoor workers. They were the people who raised the crops on which the Southern economy was based because it was primarily an agricultural economy. So these people knew slavery in its absolutely most, in its harshest forms, in its most oppressive forms. These were the people who had the most difficult struggle, and most of them are not well known today. Their narratives are not well known today. They partly because they feature a great many atrocities that are extremely hard to read, partly because they don't tell the same sort of story of social mobility that you get in the narratives of, say, Frederick Douglass or William Wells Brown or some of the other more famous slave narrators whose stories are really about upward mobility, not just I go from slavery to freedom and then in freedom I start moving up and I start distinguishing myself, but their stories are also about what I did to distinguish myself while I was a slave.
Well, tell us about James Roberts.
James Roberts is an example of someone who was sold away from his wife and children when he was a young man after he had fought for the cause of United States freedom in the Revolutionary War. And, of course, slaves who were offered the chance to fight in the war were also told that they would receive their freedom if they perform this service. James Roberts did not receive his freedom. He was sold away from his family in Maryland and sold to Louisiana, where he became an agricultural worker, a so-called field hand, and saw the absolute worst of Deep South slavery on cotton and indigo plantations. He struggled. He fought. He experienced masters who were nothing short of sadists. We don't know how he got out of slavery. He doesn't tell us in his narrative. But it's pretty clear that even after he got out of slavery, he was struggling to keep body and soul together, to make a living. He's the kind of man who had a strong conviction that white people simply could not be trusted, not in the South, not in the North, that he was so suspicious of whites that he's one of the very few, if not the only, pre-1865 narrator to expressly find a black person to help him write his story. Did not trust white people to do it. So his perspective is one a great deal more bitterness and resentment, a great deal more suspicion and outrage than you find from some of the people at the higher echelons who tend to emphasize more what I was able to accomplish, how I was able to get out, and how I was able to move up once I got out of slavery.
And you argue that class actually cut both ways within enslaved communities, right?
Yes, it could. White people had a role. Slaveholders had a role in creating different classes of work. They would assign certain types of slaves, certain kinds of work, indoor work, domestic work, let's say, and they'd give other slaves outdoor work. And I think within those more advantaged slaves groups, they tended to create their own special, what they call confidential slaves. These were slaves who were given special rights and privileges because the master could rely on them to inform on what was going on as far as what slaves might be thinking about or who might be getting ready to run away or who was lying in wait for the overseer once they could catch him at an unwary time. So the masters wanted to create differences, social and reputational status differences, so that they could try to exploit them.
Divide and conquer was the old trick from the beginning.
But the really impressive thing about reading these narratives is how so many of the people who wrote these stories turned that system to work for themselves by taking the skills and opportunities that they were able to get from the slaveholding class, which the slaveholding class didn't give them out of any kindness of their hearts. They gave it to them because they thought it would make them more profitable. And then they turned that into their own mechanisms for developing the skills they need in order either to buy their way out of slavery or to escape from slavery.
These narratives also offer insight into the many reasons that people did not attempt, for those who did not attempt to escape.
Yeah, one of the problems that we might have in reading these narratives of these people who were able to extricate themselves from slavery is to think, well, then if these people could do this, why weren't there a lot more people doing this? So it's easy to get this idea that we still hear today that, well, you know, if you only try it hard enough to get out of extreme poverty, you do it. Because, look, these people got out of slavery. They were just determined not to stay in slavery, and so they did everything necessary to get out, and they got out. Well, the narratives show many people who do not attempt to escape from slavery and do not buy their way out, they are not portrayed as people who lack ambition or who are somehow inferior to those who have made the ultimate sacrifice. Instead, these people are people who are in most cases connected to their families and their loved ones in such a way that they simply cannot conceive of running away. If they do that, they leave behind their wives and children. They're responsible for their grandmothers and grandfathers. They can't just up and leave. Most of the famous slave narratives that we have from the period that I'm writing about were authored by people who were not married and who didn't have children.
William Andrews is the author of Slavery and Class in the American South, A Generation of Slave Narrative Testimony from 1840 to 1865, also a professor in the Department of English and Comparative Literature at UNC Chapel Hill. Bill, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, performance artist Tristan Parks creates a spiritual workshop in communion with James Baldwin. We get a preview just ahead. Stay tuned.